So I texted my brother. He's like, just to clarify, the fox was coming towards my car when dad stopped me. And secondly, it was a baby fox, not a full-grown fox. And I'm like, how does that make a difference?
Hey, there's reasoning. He has reasoning. Yeah,
now what's going to happen is the baby fox is going to jump in your car and all the other foxes are going to come attack your ass. I know,
the mama fox is
going to
be like, give me back my baby. Ugh, yeah, Josh.
That was an update on the fox. Yeah, that it was a baby and that the did work. It was coming towards him.
He was speaking fox.
He was. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of State of Murder. I'm your host, Selena Cooper.
And I'm your other host, Amber Ratzloff.
And we are in Arkansas today.
Yeah.
Or Arkansas, if you want to be like that, I guess. It's spelled yep. Arkansas. I think that's a funner way to say it.
I think it is, too. So I don't really know a lot about Arkansas. So I only can name one city in Arkansas. No, I can name two cities in Arkansas. Little Rock and a very small town called Mountain Pine, which is the home of Bobby Bones. He's a country radio show personality. That one, Dancing with the Stars.
Nice.
So there's two cities I can name.
Yeah, I really just knew Little Rock, and that's about it. So yeah.
There's a song with Little Rock in it.
Oh, yeah? What?
Down here in Little Rock. That's all I remember.
Speaking of country music, did you hear about the drama with Lady Antebellum? Would they be considered... They were country, right?
Yeah, they're country.
Yeah. How they changed
their
name.
First of all, I've always had a problem with their name. I was like, why are you... First of all, it's a guy. It's two guys and a girl. So why are they called Lady? And then... Third of all, was that three things? I don't remember. I got on a tangent. But, like, Antebellum is not necessarily a good thing. It isn't a good thing. And so to be named that, I always had an issue with it. And now that bullshit where they changed their name to Lady A.
Yes, and now they're suing the original Lady A.
I saw that.
Yep. So I'm like, what assholes? You tried to be, like... Oh, we're going to do what's right. And now you're suing some lady who has been using this stage name since the 80s?
Yeah. Also, Devil's advocate here is the fact that Lady Antebellum actually does have the trademark for it.
Lady A?
Mm-hmm. When
did they get that?
2011, I guess. The Blues Lady A or the Soul Lady A that sings it. She, I guess, maybe didn't file for that. I don't know, because maybe she wasn't big enough. I don't know. But that's
but
what
really
I read,
who
at least.
Thinks of that?
Yeah, I know. Huh? Who knows? Yeah. And you have to be established for a little while, I guess. But I listen to country music, and I have never called Lady Antebellum Lady A. Like, I've never used that. I mean, I know they do use it sometimes, but it's not necessarily one that I would think of for them.
Yeah, either way, that's a terrible name for a band, and more appropriate for a single woman singer to be called Lady A rather than a group. You are correct, is two guys and a girl.
Yeah.
Call yourself something else.
Yeah, I listen to them. I like some of their songs. So
I only like the one that was popular, the I'm a little drunk and I need you now. That one.
Yeah.
And then I like their version of Baby, It's Cold Outside. But nope, not no more. It's coming off my Christmas song list.
Oh, no. Banished from the Christmas list.
Banished.
I liked one of their new songs that just came out that was on Songland. So now I can't listen to that. It's a summertime song.
Got to find something else.
No.
Listen to the Dixie Chicks. Listen to Chicks' new song.
I love me some Chicks. Yeah, because they're the Chicks. They're not the Dixie Chicks anymore. They're the Chicks. There you go. Makes the perfect sense.
It does. Because they are three Chicks.
Yep. Goes well.
Mm-hmm. So. Their new song is good. I like it. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it is good.
All right. We went off on another tangent. Sorry, Arkansas.
Don't we always?
All right. So do you want to tell us about your case this week?
Yeah, this week I actually didn't really pick a political or like kind of, you know, it doesn't really fit with anything that's going on in the world right now, but that's okay. So this week's case, I'm going to be sharing with you guys about Ron and Mary Lee Orsini and Bill and Alice MacArthur. Now, from what I've read about Mary Lee, she didn't grow up with a lot. She grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, right next to the Little Rock Air Force Base. So her dad was a cattle rancher and her mom worked in the school cafeteria, so kind of as a lunch lady, but then also drove the school bus after school and before school. So Mary Lee's family did not have a lot of money. So a lot of articles said they were dirt poor. And I don't like when people describe it that way, because poor doesn't always necessarily mean dirty. So I always have a hard time with that.
Well, I thought it was because, like, when you're dirt poor, like, people had dirt floors. Like,
that's true. But I always picture, like, that they're unkempt.
Oh, okay. Two different interpretations, I guess. Sure.
So Mary Lee didn't want people believing that she grew up really without anything. She wanted everybody to assume that she was kind of a refined society girl. So that's how she kind of wanted, she tried to have herself portrayed. However, she ended up dropping out of high school in the 10th grade and getting married at the age of 16. She actually married one of the guys from the Air Force Base, ended up divorcing him, then remarrying him, and then divorcing him again, and then getting married again to some other guy. So she was married three times by the time she met Ron Orsini in 1976.
Does it count as another, when you married the same guy twice? Isn't that just like you split up and then got back together again?
Yeah, but they got divorced and then remarried and then divorced again. So I don't know. So yeah, maybe married to two different guys, but three times. Not making fun of it. Just sometimes that happens. And she got married young. So, I mean, of course you're young and stupid. So she probably wasn't even kind of really aware of what she wanted in life.
Yeah.
So she met and ended up marrying Ron Orsini in 1976. And Ron was a partner at the Central Heating and Air. So he was kind of an engineer, like air heating and air conditioning engineer, I guess is what they called him. So, and he worked just southwest of Little Rock, Arkansas. So by all accounts, Ron and Mary Lee led pretty normal lives during that time. So Ron, a lot of times, would end up going to bed pretty early and would have to get up because he would have to travel for his job to like distances, like 60, 70 miles. And so they didn't always end up sharing a bedroom because he was being considerate and, you know, had to wake up really early and didn't want to wake up Mary Lee. So he would a lot of times go into the other bedroom and sleep there. So this happened on the morning of March 13th, 1981. Ron was sleeping in a room by himself, so he wouldn't wake Mary Lee when he went to work. So I'm going to share with you the account of this day from Mary Lee's telling of it. So we always have to do this because the people that survive are the people that we find the story about. Mm-hmm. So Mary Lee said that she got up on March 13th, got up and woke her daughter and got her ready for school. Then she drove her daughter was in the seventh grade at this point. So she ended up driving her daughter to school, dropped her off, and then came back to the house. When she then noticed that the door to the bedroom that Ron usually slept in was locked. And she thought, oh, that's really weird. He never locks it. I wonder why it's locked. And so she knocked on it and he didn't answer the door. So she became more and more concerned. So she ended up running to the neighbor's house to get help. She and her neighbor returned to the house and were able to break into the bedroom door. There they found Ron in bed with a gunshot wound to the back of his head. So he was laying kind of stomach down and he'd been shot in the back of the head by a 38 caliber gun. So at that time, Mary Lee ended up calling the police, and when they arrived, they were told about how the door had been locked and that Mary and her neighbor had to break it down. And that is where so this kind of became a murder mystery for people. So when you look it up, there's all these like kind of mystery blogs on how was Ron Orsini murdered? Mm-hmm. Because apparently the windows were locked. And the door, they didn't say what kind of lock it was, but in all of the accounts, it was a lock that you couldn't lock and then leave and it be locked. You had to be in the room to lock it and unlock it. I didn't see pictures or anything of the lock, so I don't quite understand that portion, but it was just confusing because no way could somebody have left the room after the murder.
It was like a doorknob lock, not like he had a, like, because I would get it if it was like a chain lock, like obviously you can't maneuver in there to.
It didn't say. That's, I know, I spent so much time trying to find out about this lock. Like, I was doing so much research because I was like, so is it like a key or, I don't know. But they just said that.
Because it could be a key where you have to lock it and no one can open it from the outside. Yeah. Oh, okay, so it could be that.
It could be that, it could be whatever. Mm-hmm. So either way, it could only be locked from the inside and you couldn't pull the door shut afterwards. And keep it locked. So how can somebody have entered, killed him, and then left? So a complete mystery. So they started looking into Ron's background, and they didn't really see anything that was glaringly obvious on why somebody would want him dead. And of course, you know, every time somebody dies, they look at the people closest to them. So the police started investigating Mary Lee. This is when they started to notice holes in her story. The police found out she was in some pretty serious financial trouble. I got a lot of my information from some court cases. There were a couple of articles from the Arkansas Gazette. And then there was an episode on City Confidential, the very first season in 1991, episode 6, was based off of this case. So I got some of my information from there. So in City Confidential, it mentioned that their house was about to be foreclosed on. And right after Ron was murdered, all of a sudden it was paid off. So she didn't owe any back mortgage anymore. And it was found that the money came from Ron's life insurance policy.
Hmm.
So putting those things together. Mary Lee swore, however, that she had nothing to do with her husband's murder. And it was her number one priority to find out who had done it. However, the police moved forward and tried to take their case to the grand jury. So Mary Lee ended up getting a very prestigious, well-known defense attorney in Arkansas. So she hired him, and his name was Bill MacArthur. So a little bit about Bill MacArthur. He rose up in the Little Rock. There was a lot of new money in Little Rock at that time in the 80s. And so, like, Bill Clinton was kind of big in the 80s. So that kind of group of guys were growing up and becoming kind of important in Arkansas at the time. So Bill MacArthur was one of those guys. So he kind of was part of the elite society in Little Rock. He was a very, very successful attorney. So he was married to Alice and they had two children. So Alice was really well liked. So she was considered a real sweetheart. She loved to play tennis. She was a stay-at-home mom. And then they said that if you went to the tennis club, you could always find her because everybody around her would be laughing because she was so funny and everybody just really enjoyed being around her. So by the early 1980s, Bill's practice was going really well. He was very liked. So he was trusted by the police and he was really trusted by the judges. So he was pretty successful in getting people off.
Okay.
So I didn't know if he had that Southern charm or what. They considered him, he had blonde hair. They thought he was pretty attractive. He was just, you know, he fit that kind of persona.
Mm-hmm.
Besides practicing law, Bill also ended up becoming a partner in the BJ Star Studded Honky Tonk. So it was.
So, what a name.
I know, BJ Star Studded Honky Tonk. So I guess, I don't know. I mean, I was alive in the 80s, but in Arkansas, there was a huge nightlife with kind of cowboy disco music in the early
80s. What is cowboy disco music?
I have no idea. I didn't listen to it, but that's what they, so it's a lot of rhinestones because I saw a lot of pictures of people like in rhinestones and cowboy boots and looking like they had a lot of fun in that nightlife. So,
wow.
Yeah, so apparently this nightclub, it opened in the fall of 1981, and there was a lot of suspicious fires and other incidents that happened at the nightclub, and the county sheriff's department believed this was because there was a rise in organized crime at the time in central Arkansas. So
what
mafia.
The hell?
I know,
that
very
does not
strange.
Seem like a place for mafias bosses to want to go. Let's go to Arkansas.
Yeah, Central Arkansas. I think maybe because there was, I guess it was, there was new money there, and it's kind of prosperous, and maybe that they thought that that was drawing this mafia element. So this mafia piece will come to play later in the story. So just keeping that in mind. But first, we're going to go back to Mary Lee.
Okay.
So Mary Lee, according to a number of sources, loved to be in the spotlight. So she always wanted to be in that elite circle. So remember, growing up, she wanted people to think she was kind of that socialite person kid, mm-hmm. and that she was raised really refined. So she, I think part of that in her money troubles and why she all of a sudden, the house was going to be foreclosed on, was that she was living above her means and her husband just didn't know about it. After she hired Bill MacArthur, he was giving her some advice, but she kept wanting to be in the limelight. So she always sought out the media's attention. So like I said before, she stated, like on interviews, she would always state that she was never going to leave the face of this earth until she found out who killed her husband, Ron. And she said she was going to be obsessed with it, and she was totally going to find out who did it. So Mary Lee even ended up paying a number of private investigators to look into the murder of her husband. During this time, however, Mary Lee started dating a number of men. And one of these, yeah, so they said 3 or 4.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I guess, spreading her wings.
I mean, you do you, but I feel like if your husband is suspected of being murdered, that might not be the best image you want to portray of a grieving widow. I mean, I'm just saying, if you want to be all up in the spotlight, that might not be the way to go.
Yeah. You're playing, hey, like the grieving widow of, like, I'm going to find out who murdered him. And then, like, you're out about town with a whole bunch of different guys. I mean, however you want to grieve, I mean,
you do you.
So one of these guys that she started dating was a known drug dealer named Eugene Yankee Hall. So
was Yankee's real middle name or a nickname?
They always had it in quotation marks. So some articles just called him Yankee Hall. And so it took me a while to find out his real first name was Eugene. So maybe he just didn't like being called that. I don't know. So he went usually by Yankee Hall, though. Yeah.
That was Flynn Rider's real name in Tangled. Remember? It was Eugene.
Eugene. So that is true. So maybe he didn't like it. So Hall shared that when he started dating Mary Lee, she seemed really interested, kind of almost obsessed with Bill MacArthur. She would spend a lot of her time down in his office. So she would just show up there. She would hang out with his other lawyers and other people at his practice. She even ended up hosting a champagne birthday party for Bill. And then she would also go down to that BJ's star-studded honky-tonk and hang out with Bill and his wife, Alice. So that she kind of started trying to befriend them. So on May 21st, 1982, Alice was at home getting ready to go play tennis when she got into her car and started driving down the driveway when a bomb went off in her car.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, so it had been placed in her car. Luckily for her, though, it didn't detonate correctly. And so she only ended up having minor, like, scratches and cuts on her legs, and she walked away pretty much completely fine. But
holy shit.
I know. Amazing. People were quick to tie this bombing to organized crime because, remember, the sheriffs were so sure that there was a lot of mafia in Central Arkansas at this time. And Mary Lee even made statements stating that she and Alice were on a hit list from the mafia. Mary Lee was telling everybody during this time that the people who had killed her husband, Ron, were now after her, and that people kept trying to break into her house. And then Mary Lee one day ended up driving to Bill's office, and her car window had been shattered and she had glass in her hair. And she had stated when she got there that somebody had tried to assassinate her while she was driving.
She kept driving?
Yeah. So the weird thing is that she ended up driving by two police stations before she even got to Bill's office. So if somebody was trying to kill you or assassinate you,
yes.
I mean, the first place, if I saw a police station, that is probably where I would choose to stop and not go to my lawyer. Because what the hell is he going to do?
Yeah, definitely. She should have gone to the police station for help.
Yeah. So she had a lot of stories to tell, Mary Lee did. So none of them ever could be proven to be true. On Friday, July 2nd of 1982, Bill and Alice made plans to go out of town for the holiday, for the 4th of July holiday weekend. They were planning to go to the lake with a whole bunch of friends as their kids were actually away at summer camp at this time. Bill was supposed to be getting off work early so that they could meet up and then drive together, so Alice and him. Bill had to wait to leave, however, because Mary Lee ended up showing up at his office unannounced. So once she got there, it was clear to Bill that she didn't really have actually any business to discuss with him. She was never indicted for, at that time, for the murder of her husband, Ron. The grand jury didn't indict her so that she never went to trial for that murder. So Bill was successful in kind of getting those charges to be dropped at the time. So I guess he is a good attorney. I don't know. So Bill kind of shooed her out of the office and he ended up going home. So he got there around 5 p.m. And when he entered the house, he started looking around for his wife, Alice. So he noticed when he looked in their den that her cigarettes and all of her belongings were in that room, but she wasn't there. So he walked around the house and then he ended up going outside and he still didn't find her. And so he ended up calling the police. They then, with Bill, located Alice's body in a bedroom closet. She had been shot in the head and there was a bouquet of flowers resting by her feet with a card on it that stated, "Have a nice day."
What the fuck?
A neighbor reported that earlier that day, she had actually witnessed two men delivering flowers that afternoon, but that it had appeared odd to her because the car didn't have a license plate on it. And then the flower shop sign on the car had been handmade. So it's just like a fake, like, I don't know, drawing of like a flower, what they imagine a flower like van or something, or what would be on a car would be on there. Yeah, so pretty strange. Then there was an anonymous telephone call that was made a couple days after the murder that pointed the finger at Larry Darnell McClendon. And they found fingerprints also on the bouquet of flowers that belonged to one Eugene Yankee Hall. So after that, they ended up arresting those two guys. And they were quick to state that Mary Lee had hired them to kill Alice and had promised to pay them $25,000 after it was done. She'd actually told them that Bill MacArthur had wanted his wife killed and that he would pay them the $25,000 after they had killed. Oh my God.
This chick is insane. This is like Fatal Attraction.
I know, right? The problem was, after they committed the murder, it didn't seem like Bill... There are differing sides on whether or not Bill was involved in this. We'll talk about it in a little bit. But
okay.
Mary Lee did not have the $25,000 to give to the two guys. And so they found out that she had actually had somebody call, and she gave a script to a guy to call in and give the anonymous tip. So she turned in the two guys that pointed the finger at her.
Oh my God.
Because she didn't have the money to pay them. So what were they going to do? Like,
so yeah, then they were just going to come for her.
Yep, exactly. So I know. So Bill also ended up getting arrested for the murder of his wife. So if you watch City Confidential, and there are a number of articles, I'm not going to get into it because all of a sudden it takes a turn into politics. And there's a sheriff that some say kind of had a vendetta against Bill almost. He probably really did think that he played a part in his wife's murder. Alice had just come into a whole bunch of money. So she had gotten inheritance where she was getting $50,000. A month from, she was from Louisiana and some oil money. So there was some speculation on she wasn't giving the money to him. She was putting it in a trust for their kids. And so I think there was some speculation on that because she hadn't put it in a trust. And then Mary Lee kept telling everybody that she and Bill had had an affair and that Alice had been planning on divorcing Bill and taking the kids and that she was a horrible woman. So that's her story. And so the sheriff kind of followed her story. However, the grand jury did not indict him. They didn't find any real evidence to prove anything against him. So Bill was, he was arrested, but then he was released. So he was never charged with his wife's murder. Hall, so Yankee Hall, pled guilty to murdering Alice, and he ended up getting life in prison. And McClendon, his friend who helped him with it, received 20 years sentence for his role in the murder. And the interesting thing about that is that they say that he was the shooter. So he's actually apparently the shooter, the one that shot Alice, but he only is serving 20. He only got 20 years.
Huh.
So
interesting.
That, yeah. Whereas Yankee Hall got life in prison. Mary Lee also got life in prison without the possibility of parole. And then in 1983, she was found guilty of the murder of her husband, Ron. So, however, this was overturned. This guilty verdict was overturned by the state Supreme Court. And I don't know why. I cannot find a single, like, reason. All it ever says is that she was found guilty and then the state Supreme Court overturned it.
Hmm.
So,
but they don't, that's interesting. Most places give a reason.
I know. No article talks about it. So for 22 years, Mary Lee swore that she was innocent, that she had nothing to do with Ron's murder. She never talked about being innocent of Alice's killing, but she always said that she never killed her husband, Ron. However, in 2003, right before she passed away from a heart attack, she ended up confessing that she had, in fact, murdered her husband. So she stated that she got up early in the morning, and there was a way that you could actually break into the door. You had to have an Allen wrench. So she got an Allen wrench, figured out how to lock the door after her. She got up, went and shot him in the head with a gun. They had an extra gun. And then quickly locked the door behind her, took off her bloody clothes, took the Allen wrench and the gun, drove to a remote area, threw all of the stuff in the swamp, and got back in time for when her daughter woke up. So,
wow.
So she could, and then she also ended up confessing that she was the one who helped that place the bomb in Alice's car. So that bombing. So nothing actually ever really was attributed to the mafia. The only thing really that they could was that Yankee Hall was a low-level drug dealer. But other than that, like all of her stories, and people just bought it. So if you watch City Confidential, it's really interesting because they interview Yankee Hall and he is like, that woman snowed me so good. Like, because she planted a whole bunch of evidence, apparently, to get him to be charged with the bombing as well as the murder. And so she apparently had him wrapped around her finger and he just kind of went along with whatever she said. And now he's in prison for it.
Jesus.
So, and then Bill MacArthur also, she, I believe, passed away in 2009. So,
okay.
But that's my story of Mary Lee Orsini's crazy little story.
That had so many twists and turns.
I know.
I was like, wait, what? Now there's car bombs? I was like, is it really, is it the mafia?
I know. I love, and she's always like, the mafia, it's the mafia. And well, and that the fact that the sheriffs are the ones that kind of started building everybody to believe that. And maybe there was mafia and some, like, crime syndicates in Little Rock in the early 80s. Maybe there was. I don't know. But I just thought it was funny that that was. And it was actually just this kind of woman who really,
was
really
crazy.
Was obsessed with her attorney and wanted to be a part of the certain lifestyle and was trying to find her way into it.
That's crazy. All right. Well, thank you for your story.
Yeah. What story do you have for us this week, Selena? All right.
So I'm doing the Westside Middle School shooting. So just trigger warning. I mean, it's called it's a school shooting story. So just if you, this is too triggering, just skip ahead to the fun state facts.
Yes.
But on March 24th, 1998, Jonesboro, Arkansas would be the site of one of the deadliest massacres at a non-college school in U.S. history. And this was because Columbine wouldn't happen for another year, I think, depending on the month. And so this is one of the deadliest ones that's not a college, because obviously like the Texas, Texas University happened way before that and stuff like that. So the shooters were Mitchell Scott Johnson, 13, and Andrew Golden, 11.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, babies. They are also, they are also one of the youngest people to commit a crime like this. Johnson was born in Minnesota, and when he was 7, his parents split up, leading to his mother moving him and his brother to Jonesboro. There, his mother remarried to a man named Terry Woodward, and he was a former inmate at the prison where she worked as a guard. Oh. And I finally found it. Because I thought, whoa, okay, like maybe like it was not a crazy type of crime or whatever. Like, I don't know how a guard falls for an inmate, but it was felony drug and weapons charges. So I was like, okay, I mean, I wouldn't, but you do, I guess. So, and it didn't really go too much. It, like, all the articles I read just kind of glossed over the fact that she married a prisoner.
And that she was guarding?
So I was like, okay, we're just going to ignore that. Okay, that works. But I just thought it was interesting to mention. Johnson was a member of a church choir. He had a good relationship with his parents, even had a good relationship with his stepfather, Terry, and was described as a pretty quiet child, I think, as most kids are described, like when they're 13, like when they're young, they're just quiet kids. It would later come out that Johnson was molested by a family member, though, of the daycare where he was sent back in Minnesota. So that would have been sometime before he was 7 years old.
Oh my goodness.
But his parents didn't find out until later. This would lead to an incident in 1997, which is just a year before the shooting, where Johnson was charged with molesting a 3-year-old while he was visiting his family in Minnesota. But again, like, it didn't give me too much on it. Not that I really want to know any more than that. That's
enough.
Yeah. But definitely could see that whatever happened to him as a kid, there was some trauma there that was undealt with. This record was expunged, however, due to his age. So he would have been like 12 at the time. And so because of his age, they just expunged it off his record. It didn't tell me like what happened with the whole case or the trial happened. But Andrew Golden, the other kid, was a Jonesboro native who came from a stable household. He had a good relationship with his family and stayed out of trouble for the most part. His father was the leader of the local gun club.
And Andrew's the 11-year-old?
Yes. Okay. Andrew Golden is the 11-year-old.
Okay.
And so his father was the leader of the local gun club called the Jonesboro Practical Pistol Shooters. That's a mouthful. And from a young age, Golden was taught how to hunt and had even begun what they call practical shooting, which is basically like a shooting sport type thing where they're testing like speed, accuracy, and power. So it's a lot of like hitting moving targets and things like that.
Okay.
He was apparently a pretty good shot, although he did move kind of slow, his dad said, but he was still learning. I mean, he's 11.
Yeah.
Jesus. Already too young to hold a gun, in my opinion, but you do you, I guess. I'm not one to judge. I think Arkansas is they're a pretty conservative state, right? So a lot of Second Amendment supporters there.
Yeah, well, and I also think a lot of avid hunters, because you have a lot of small towns, and just I think there's a lot of hunting that goes on in Arkansas.
Yeah, and hunting, I don't agree with it, but I guess you do you, but the practical shooting, though, I'm like, why are we teaching him this at 11? Like, who needs to know how to shoot a moving target at 11? Really? But okay. So, my personal opinions aside, Johnson and Golden met while attending Westside Middle School. and riding the bus together to school. The pair were known as bullies at school and not super popular. I kept trying to find a little bit more about it because some people describe Golden as being like a nice kid. The teachers never really knew him to get in trouble, whereas Johnson seemed to be the one who was more of the instigator. But it seems like when they were together, they would bully other kids. Fellow students recalled Johnson talking about his desire to join the Bloods, which for those of you who don't know is a primarily African-American gang. And if you couldn't tell by the name Mitchell Johnson, he is a white boy from Arkansas, or from Minnesota, who lives in Arkansas. But the Bloods is a gang. So he talked about his desire to join them. Some even remember him saying that he was in a gang, but he would also flip-flop between the Bloods and the Crips, which I thought was interesting because they're rival gangs.
Yeah.
But okay. But he did have a fascination with drugs and weapons. They would talk about wanting to go smoke marijuana all the time and wanted to be in a gang. He was just fascinated by that lifestyle. Golden shared his admiration of weapons. And a classmate even believes that Golden killed her cat with a BB gun. Mm. And I did read one article where a friend of his said that he had bragged about killing the cat and throwing it away.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
I hate the animal brutality. It's like, stop.
I know. But if you're already killing animals, that's like that's a pretty good indicator. Yeah.
That there's something wrong.
I'm sensing some warning signs that seem to be going amiss. Because like I said, the teachers were all pretty much like, there was one incident where after everything happened that a teacher was like, oh, if you would have told me this was the kid, he would have been like the last kid I would have thought would have done that. But then I learned all these things and I'm like, really? Like even at 11 years old, he killed a cat with a BB gun.
Yeah.
But anyway.
In Arkansas, you probably have the boys will be boys mentality. I'm just guessing. Well, I mean, I know we're stereotyping a little bit, but I just picture that.
Yeah. And who knows? I mean, I think that kind of happens in some rural settings. It's not a very large town. So that could also be the mentality. Plus it's the 90s. I think everyone was still in that whole boys will be boys mindset in the late 90s. So.
Well, and even with the, like, kind of the obsession with gangs, because, I mean, there's so many movies in the 90s came out were about gang rivalries, and so I just wonder if that kind of played a part into it in, like, pop culture.
Mm-hmm. That, too, like, hip-hop music and things like that back in, I think, in the 90s were very much, like, not like the rappers, if you want to call them that today, but again, personal opinion. But back in the day, it was a lot of, like, it was more street cred type stuff where they would talk about that in the music. Not saying hip hop causes people to shoot.
No,
it doesn't. More just like what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So in January, just 3 months before the incident, a classmate reported to a counselor at the school that Golden had intended to shoot some people at the school. The counselor called Golden into their office, but he simply stated that he had a nightmare that he did go through with his plan and he was killed as a result of it. So he didn't want to go through with it anymore. And that was kind of all I found. I didn't know if there were multiple sessions and eventually he said this or if it was ever told to his parents or what the situation was, but that's kind of the only thing, which again, kind of irritates me because I'm like, if a kid is thinking these things, that's a sign, whether he says he's going to actually go through with it or not, I feel like that's signs of a deeper issue going on that requires more than him just saying he had a nightmare where he died. So that's what made him decide he wasn't going to do it anymore.
Yeah, no remorse, like, for thinking about other people, too. It was just, like, what affects him.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Again, I couldn't find much on it, so I'm not going to blame the counselor for it. I don't know what was going on. So the day before the incident, Johnson spoke with a former girlfriend and told her to stay home from school. I know, he was 13.
My face.
Apparently this kid had a few.
I was like, wait, what now?
Yeah, I know. The listeners can't see your face, but you were like, what? Yes. And he had told her to stay home from school because he had heard that something bad was going to happen. And friends of Golden recall him saying that he had, quote, a lot of killing to do, and that they would all find out the next day if it was their destiny to live or die. Which, I'm sorry, if someone told me that, even if he was supposedly a friend, my ass would for sure be telling my mom and dad, like, This kid said he was going to kill everybody. Like, what? Mm-hmm. Okay. But yeah, so it was a lot of stuff. Back to the girlfriend thing. It was brought up later, and I'll bring it up here since I mentioned it, that this, I don't know if it was this girlfriend, the one he told to stay home, or if it was another girl, but one of the other girls who apparently was, like, his girlfriend, she stated that they never were together, that he just wanted to be, and she said no, and then he would, like, threaten her and be upset at her, and so she kind of felt like she was the target of this whole thing because she had rejected him, and he got very upset, and he started being really mean to her, which, just future reference, if someone tells you no, being mean to them is only proving their decision to say no even more correct. Yes. Like, don't be a dick. People have the right to say no. Anyways. So yeah, so I don't know if this former girlfriend was the same girl or another girl that maybe, so I don't know how how loose they're being with the term girlfriend. That night, the two boys loaded up Johnson's parents' Dodge Caravan with snack foods, weapons, and camping supplies. Among the weapons, there was a Remington 742 rifle. There's more numbers, sorry, but I don't know how to say it in gun terms. A Universal 30 M1 carbine replica, a Ruger 44 Magnum rifle, a Smith & Wesson 38 special revolver, a Double Deuce Buddy 22 caliber two-shot Derringer. That's all one gun, that whole sentence. The FIE 380 pistol, Star 380 pistol, Ruger Security 6 357 revolver, Davis Industries 38 two-shot Derringer, and a Charter Arms 38 special revolver. I don't know. I had to look up all of these guns, and the only reason I'm reading them to you now is because hopefully you know something about guns and this is reference. I just wanted to show the pure, like, number of weaponry that these kids were able to get their hands on. Also, some of these looked like super ornate, like more like collectible guns. Like, some of these guns looked like they were from, like, way back in the day type, like Wild West type looking guns, like little pistol types. None of them were anything like a Smith & Wesson revolver is like what you picture when you like think of a revolver. Like, it's not like any sort of automatic weapons or things like that. And they had a lot of hunting rifles, so it's a lot of hunting guns and things like that.
But what you said to me when you were, that was a bunch of gibberish to me. I'm was like,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but I did want to point out, because if other people know also too, like, even if you don't know all the rest of the stuff, you can understand the fact that there were rifles, revolvers, Derringers, pistols. Like, they had a variety of weapons. It was basically anything they could get their hands on. And these guns had been taken from both Golden's dad and his grandfather, along with around 2,000 rounds of ammo. So they were full on preparing for some stuff with that many weapons and that much ammo. Also, too, while we're on the topic of all these guns, please, 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 if you are going to be a gun owner, be a responsible one. Keep all of these things locked up and secured to where an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old cannot get their hands on them that easily. Mm-hmm. Because how could both the dad and the grandfather, those are two separate households, how could they not notice that all their guns are missing? And, or not all of their guns, but a good amount of them. And like I said, some of these seemed pretty ornate. And also, how could they get their hands on that much ammo? If you're going to have the guns in the house, at least keep the ammo somewhere that the kids have no access to. Like, it boggled. Anyways. So the next morning, the two boys missed the bus. And then Johnson told his mom that his stepdad was going to drive him to school, even though his stepdad had already left. His mom didn't know that yet. And so he took the keys to the stepdad's car. I don't know what car the stepdad was in. Either way, he took the stepdad's car and he stole the keys and took off. And he picked up Golden. And so both boys are dressed in like full on camo, like camping stuff, hats, pants, jackets, all that. So the boys drove to the school, and when they arrived, Golden went into the building while Johnson took the van to the woods behind the school where it would be hidden. So he kind of had a spot to park everything. The way it looked is there was a school and then a big field that backed into what looked like a wooded area. And so they were a little ways away. And apparently construction was happening at the school too. They were redoing some building. And so there's construction happening. So they just went where nobody could see them. Golden pulled the fire alarm at the start of fifth period, which is around 12:30 p.m. And a student recalled him pulling the fire alarm and exiting the building. And so she went in and told her teacher as the teacher was getting everybody ready to go out to the field, because the teachers were kind of in shock because normally they're notified if there's going to be a drill that's happening. And so even though the student came in and was like, oh, Andrew pulled the fire alarm, the teacher was like, okay, he's just going to get in trouble after this, but we still got to go just in case there really was a fire. So as the teachers and students began to exit the building, unsure if it was a drill or a fire, Golden and Johnson opened fire. Initially, people thought it was fake, so they recall some people saying that it's fake. Others thought it was firecrackers or maybe some of the construction that was happening, because people remember it sounding similar to whatever they were doing in that other building. But once people started to fall to the ground, everybody panicked and ran for the doors. Children were ushered into the gymnasium after staff discovered that the other building doors that they had come from locked automatically behind them due to the drill. So it was part of this flawed safety system that once the fire drill is activated, once you exit the building itself shuts off, like locks itself, I guess, to keep the fire contained.
Yeah.
But also that's not ideal in this situation where if people need to get back in the building. Also, I don't know how that works as far as like the fire department coming in, whatever. That's a whole nother thing. Either way, the door is locked. And so the kids were having to all rush to this one area. And as you can imagine, everything was chaos, right?
Yeah.
Kids are falling. People are kind of tripping over each other. Everyone's trying to find a door that's opening. Some teachers heard what was all the commotion and were opening those doors that were locked because they were still coming out. So there was only like a few classes that ended up getting out. So luckily it wasn't the whole school that had exited yet. It was mainly, I believe they said, like a music class and some type of, I don't know if it was drama or art or something like that, because you'll notice like a lot of the victims are women, and it was because the classes that were there were generally geared more towards female students. And so teacher Shannon Wright, who's 32, saw a student, Emma Pittman, on the ground wounded and used her body to shield her as she got her to the safety of the gym. So she basically used her body to like propel her forward to get that little girl in the gym. Shannon was hit in the chest and the abdomen and would die later on after surgery. Natalie Brooks, 11, was shot twice in the head and would die after her arrival to the ER. Stephanie Johnson, 12, was hit by a bullet that shattered and died on the sidewalk. It didn't tell me how the bullet shot. I would assume it hit the ground and burst or hit the wall. Brittany Varner, 11, called out for her friend Whitney as they were running when a bullet hit her, killing her instantly, and went through her, lodging in Whitney's back. So Whitney ended up being okay. Paige Ann Herring, 12, was hit and tried to crawl to safety but would not make it. The shooting lasted for 4 minutes, and in addition to the 5 dead, 9 students and 1 teacher would be wounded. So I'm just going to read their names, and for some of them I had how they were injured or the extent of their injuries. So Kim Candace Porter was 11. She was shot in the back. Brittany Lambie was 13, and it just said she was shot. Whitney Irving was 11, and like I said, she was the one where the bullet went through her friend and hit her in the back. Crystal Amanda Barnes, 13, was shot in the chest. Ashley Betts, 12, was wounded. Christina Amer, 12, had an injury to her right leg after her teacher, Lynette Thetford, would use her body to shield her, so prevented a bigger injury. And Lynette would sustain a gunshot wound to the abdomen because she used her body to shield Christina. Jennifer Jacobs, 12, was wounded. Jenna Brooks, 12, had her leg grazed by a bullet, and Tristan McGowan, 13, was the only boy shot that day, and he had a gunshot wound to the arm. Many others were treated for minor sprains and bruises sustained during the rush for safety. Just the sheer amount of kids that was in 4 minutes. Like, can you imagine? If the police response time had not been as quick as it was, there could have been so many more casualties to this. 911 calls flood in the moments after the shooting starts. Within 4 minutes, the police arrive. As the sirens got louder, Golden and Johnson fled to the van. Officers were alerted by construction workers who were on a rooftop near the school, because remember, they were working on that building for the school. Thankfully, they were on the rooftop, so they saw them take off running. And so they said it was two boys. They were in camouflage shirts, pants, and hats, and they were firing from the field. Officers drove their cars onto a road behind the school and stopped the boys before they made it to the van. One of the boys, it doesn't say which, briefly raised a gun at the officers but did not fire. The boys eventually dropped their weapons and complied with the officers. As officers read them their rights and put them in the car, Johnson freely confessed that it was all Golden's idea because he was mad at a teacher. Also, too, I didn't go into specifics because in the trial, they did talk about what bullets had killed who or injured who. And the teacher that Johnson said Golden was mad at and that's what he wanted to, that's why he wanted to do it, was the teacher who died, but she was killed from Johnson's gun, not from Golden's. So it was just an interesting thing. And it didn't say that Johnson was in her class or anything, so I don't know. Maybe he just knew he hit a teacher and so tried to use that. I have no idea. When asked why they did what they did or what could be done to prevent something like this in the future, Johnson said he didn't know. Also, too, this kind of took place like after a few years they were interviewed, so they were a little bit older. He said that people who don't get counseling and don't talk about it, that the stuff just boils over, and he felt that he didn't have anyone to talk to or to trust. And Golden kept insisting that Johnson had threatened to kill his family if he didn't help him. During the trial, Johnson read a letter of apology to the victims' families that read, "Hi, my name is Mitchell. My thoughts and prayers are with those people who were killed or shot and their families. I'm really sad inside about everything. My thoughts and prayers are with those kids that I go to school with. I really want people to know the real Mitchell someday. Sincerely, Mitchell Johnson." Many said that the apology and others that Johnson would make sounded dispassionate and kind of just like something he was saying. The boys were tried as juveniles and found guilty on all 5 counts of murder. They were sentenced to confinement at the Arkansas Juvenile Assessment and Treatment Center until they turned 21, which is the max sentence that you can give a juvenile under the law in Arkansas. Actually, it's 18. But the federal authorities added 3 extra years by tacking on a weapons charge. The prosecutor later said that if it wasn't for them being so young, he would have sought the death penalty for both of them. And so it really kind of had them taking a look at the laws that Arkansas had in how they treat juveniles, because it did cause some debate, because they were the only school shooters who got out of jail and were still living. To this day, they're the only ones who have done that and got free. So on August 11th, 2005, Johnson was released, and 2 years later, on May 25th, 2007, Golden was also released. Golden changed his name to Drew Grant and disappeared from the public eye until a year later when he applied for a concealed weapon permit. It was denied because upon the fingerprint scan and stuff, obviously it came up as that not being his name. And so they put it together who he was. And so he never tried to apply again that it said. So he just abandoned the idea. Golden eventually got married and had a son and went on to live a relatively quiet life in Missouri. On July 28th, 2019, Golden, who was 33 at the time, was killed in a car crash when the driver of a Tahoe collided head-on with his CRV. Him and the driver of the Tahoe died. His wife and son, who were also in the car, survived, as well as the passenger that was in the Tahoe. Johnson found himself in trouble with the law multiple times after his release. In 2007, just 2 years after he was released, he was arrested by ATF, which is it alcohol, tobacco, firearms, I believe?
Yeah.
On misdemeanor charges of carrying a loaded 9mm pistol and in possession of 21.2 grams of pot, which is just under, I believe, an ounce of pot. So not a crazy large amount, but a pretty decent size amount. He was with a roommate from the juvenile detention facility, Justin Trammell, who was driving the car they were pulled over in. Trammell was cited for reckless driving and was released, and Johnson was arrested and later released on a $1,000 bond. Okay, so the information that I got on his criminal history is kind of confusing. I tried to make it as simple as I could understand it, but some of the things were kind of jumbled. So see if maybe it makes sense to you. Okay. So anyway, he was released on bond. Later that year during trial, Johnson was found guilty on the charge of possessing a weapon while being a drug user, which I guess is a thing because he had the pot. It never said that he tested positive for it. So I don't know what happened. A few days after his conviction, he was arrested again for possession and suspicion of using a stolen credit card. So, I mean, if he was found guilty and convicted, how is he out again to do something else? So I don't know if this was a charge that was just tacked on that they discovered this had happened.
Yeah.
Or what? But I was super confused because I'm like, well, how could he be out if they found him guilty?
Well, maybe he wasn't, depending on what his, maybe he was sentenced to time served or parole or probation. I don't know. Or
maybe, well, it says he was sentenced to 4 years in prison for the weapons and drug charges. So that's why I was like, wait, what? But I don't know. It kind of threw me off because I would assume that the second you get convicted, it doesn't matter that you paid that bond. You're now remanded until sentencing or something. I don't know. If you know anything about the law, please help me clarify. I was so confused. So anyway, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison for the weapons and drug charges, and a month later pleaded guilty to the felony theft charge and misdemeanor possession charge. At age 24, just 3 years after being released from that juvenile detention facility, Johnson was sentenced to 12 years in prison for the theft and misdemeanor possession. In 2009, he was sentenced to an additional 6 years for a charge of theft by receiving and financial identity fraud for using the stolen credit card because he used that stolen credit card to buy a meal. Because he went to Burger King and bought himself a burger. See, this is how it went.
This is really confusing because he's already gotten 4 years, but 3 years later, he got 12 years.
So he got 4 years, and then he was sentenced to 12 years, and then he was sentenced to 6 years. And this was all happening just 3 years after he got out for being in the juvenile detention facility for shooting the school.
Maybe they, I know sometimes they can try individual crimes separately so that you don't get your time served consecutively.
On top.
Yeah. So you have to do them back to back to back. So like you do the 4 years, then you do the 12 years, and then you do the 6 years instead of just doing the 12 years. And so sometimes, I don't know, maybe they did it that way. So maybe this all was one incident.
It could be. Also, too, I think some charges were state, like the 12 years and the 6 years were state charges and the 4 years were federal charges. Mm-hmm. But still, I don't know why you would do the 6 and the 12 years not together if they're all the state. I don't know. I was so confused. But anyway, he was told that he'd have to complete the federal 4 years after serving his state 18. So he couldn't, count it all as one thing.
Yeah, that's what I was guessing too.
In 2011, he was eligible for parole on the state sentence and then began serving his 4 years. So
they gave him parole?
Yeah, after 3 years. Because in 2009, he was sentenced for the latest thing.
Yeah.
And so, depending on if he went to prison right that minute, from 2009 to 2011, so he served 3 of his 18 years, went on parole, but then had to go right back in to serve his 4. I don't know. In 2015, after his 4 years, Johnson was released to the probation office in Texas and put into a rehab program. So he served 7 years after facing, 22?
Yeah.
I don't know. And I think they mentioned that the reason for that was because, the whole school shoot, all of that was sealed because he was so young.
Yeah, because he was a juvenile. Yeah.
So they couldn't use that as anything. No. But either way, like, you get sentenced to all these charges. You get out.
Yeah.
And I was so confused. But anyway, he ended up in the probation because he lived in Texas. I believe he was in Texas at the time that ATF had caught him originally. And so they just put him in, he was released to the probation office and put into a rehab program. And that was the last thing I found on him. So I don't know what he's been doing for the last 5 years. Who knows? Hopefully not causing trouble or getting back into the prison system.
Yeah.
And with all of that, it makes me kind of question who really was the ringleader in the shooting. Like, Andrew's story starts making a lot more sense in that Johnson was the one who kind of threatened him to do it, especially because he ended up, Johnson ended up continuing to get into trouble, whereas Golden kind of just did his time, got out, and seemed, it didn't say anything that he was, had any other run-ins with the law. Like, even him trying to apply for the concealed weapon permit, he didn't get arrested for it. He didn't get in trouble for it. It was just like, no, you can't have a gun. Like, you can't have a concealed weapon. And he dropped it. So, I don't know. It kind of calls into, like, was that really something he wanted to do? Or was it something he felt pressured to do? It didn't even really say that the two of them were really friends at all. And the fact that Johnson turned on him so quickly, I don't know. It just makes me think that he was kind of the ringleader in all of this. But I don't know. Either way, they both did it.
Yeah. Well, and even he had the awareness after being in juvie for a while to be like, we need more mental health services.
Yeah.
That's what we always say. But yeah, so even this like teenage kid was like, I had some fucking shit happen to me and it wasn't good and I didn't process or handle it well. And
yeah.
He probably still has those issues. Maybe, hopefully, this rehab place helped him that he got stuck in Texas, helped him work on those things. But
yeah, that's the hope. But during that time, while they were in jail, a memorial bench was installed outside of Westside Middle School with the date of the shooting, and a sundial memorial was built in the park behind the school with the names of the victims. The park serves as a memorial for the five victims with five trees, five picnic tables, and five stepping stones around the sundial to represent them. In 2017, the victims' families, and so this would be when Golden was out. No, actually, both of them were out of prison because Golden had been out for a while and Johnson had just gotten out he was at the probation office at that point. The victims' families were awarded $150 million after winning a lawsuit against the two boys for damages and to prevent them from ever profiting from the shooting, which I think is the really important part there, is that they're not allowed to profit because sometimes that happens. I mean, wasn't it the son of Sam was allowed to profit from his crime?
Yeah.
And even with, like, not mass shootings, but with murders in general. I mean, OJ wrote a book.
Yeah, I was just going to say OJ, and he wasn't allowed to profit either because the Goldmans got the money, I think, for if his book, I don't even know if that book, who the fuck read that?
Yeah, we all know you did it. You don't need to hypothesize.
Know. If you did it, get out of here.
Yeah. But even too, because in, I believe it was Florida, right? George Zimmerman profited from the murder.
Trayvon Martin.
Because he was able to sell the gun and he would even sign Skittles boxes and sell them.
Ugh, so disgusting.
Fucking asshole. What a douche. Ugh, yeah. It's so upsetting. But anyway, I think that should always be a thing, is that if you murder people, or just even if you murder one person, you should not be allowed to profit off of it in any way. And I kind of blame people, like, media's fascination with it is that it's everywhere and it's all the time, so we almost treat them almost like celebrities in a way.
Yeah.
And that's why too, I'm really glad that some media outlets now, like when mass shootings happen, that they're kind of focused more on the victims and they're not really mm-hmm. giving the killers the time of day, because ultimately that's what they want, is they want that attention and they want that time of day. Like, even, what was it, the was it UC was it Santa Barbara? Him, that kid wanted a lot of attention. He wrote was it Santa Barbara? Yeah.
The one who, who was mad at girls because they didn't like him. Ugh, and he had his, manifesto. I don't remember his name, so that's good.
No, it's not important. Yeah, because it doesn't matter. But, yeah, just that idea that that's what the – just the simple fact that we know that he wrote a manifesto and he did all that. But also, unfortunately, this shouldn't even be happening. I'm a huge advocate for – tougher gun laws and more reform for this kind of stuff. Also, too, mental health plays a role in it, too. It's not just about restricting the gun laws, but it's about making sure that the people who need help, one, can get the guns, but two, that they get the help that they need. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And I think, I mean, sadly, because there have been more mass shootings, that we're more aware of some of the signs. And so looking at the signs and what led up to these guys usually doing it is helpful. So not glorifying, mm-hmm. but we need to understand the reasons behind, motivations on, especially stuff like that, so that we can get involved and have the abilities to hopefully stop it. Because obviously, this one, I'm not saying that it's the counselor's fault, and there wasn't a lot of training. Nowadays, I think they would have taken that a little more seriously than they did back in the 90s. And so if that had happened today, it would have been stopped before. But mm-hmm. in the 90s, it was kind of probably okay, yeah, good. I'm glad you dreamt that you died and you're not going to do it now.
Yeah. And especially too, because like I said, this happened a year before Columbine, and people generally attribute Columbine to being that catalyst of mm-hmm. and that was another thing I wanted to mention too, that even after this happened, I know we talked about Bill Clinton and Arkansas and that whole thing. This actually prompted him they started looking into, okay, what can be done to prevent these things? And I thought that was so terribly sad that in 1998, they're like, this can't happen again. Let's try to figure out what we can do. And here we are in 2020, and the only thing preventing another school shooting right now is the fact that there is no school and we're all on lockdown. I mean, because unfortunately, nothing's being done. It's always thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayers.
Yeah.
And more kids continue to die, and it's mm-hmm. heartbreaking. And it's not at all how it should be. Because I went to school in the 90s, early 2000s, and it wasn't like that for me, where I remember having a few kind of warning signs, but that was more about the neighborhoods surrounding us. There was something mm-hmm. going on, so they locked us down. Yeah. But kids today, it's a scary environment. I don't know how they do it. I would be like, hell no, I'm not going to school. Are you kidding me? It's more chances of dying there than anything else.
No, I definitely never had anything where it prepped for that. The biggest thing we used to, and when I was in high school, we used to have one kid who would always call in bomb threats. And so we would be exited out of the building. But I went to a school where kids could have guns, like rifles, mounted in their trucks. So,
oh shit.
I'm from Nebraska, and that's the way we do it. And so, you would have rifle mounts. And so the trucks would have 2-3 rifles in the back window. And that was a normal thing. Could you imagine that now? There's no way.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I would be terrified. That's crazy.
So just different times.
Yeah. So hopefully there's stuff that can be done about that. I think let's add a link to the blog for the gun safety. Every town, I believe, raises money for victims and to try to promote safer gun laws and just laws in general to help protect the students. Because again, it's not just one thing. We need to work on mental health in this country. Yeah. We need to work on school counselors. Like you said, some are getting the training now. Some are so overworked that they don't have time to do that. Mm-hmm. And so I think really emphasizing the importance of school counselors is huge, because they're the ones that are with the kids and they're the ones that can notice this. And really just making yourself aware of the warning signs.
Yeah.
So definitely the kids blatantly saying that they're going to shoot up the school is a huge red flag.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
killing animals. Don't kill animals. Yeah, like, not so. For hunting purposes.
Not for
torture. While I think hunting is wrong, I'm sure it's not, that's not an immediate
no
marker. But if you're just killing animals just to kill animals.
You're killing your neighbor's cat with a BB gun. That is not okay.
Yeah, asshole. Don't do that. All right. So that was my story this week.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. So now it's time for our super fun state facts.
And cities. So, I did jazz hands on that one. Did you see that?
I did. You're coming up with a dance for it and everything.
I know. Somebody do a shimmy shake, shoulder shake. This time it was jazz hands.
Changing it up. So I'm going to start with my city facts since I was from a very small town. So my super fun state fact is also very small. Now I know how you feel all the time when you pick these.
I know it's hard when you pick a small, town, you're like, what about the county? What about?
Yeah.
What's near here?
But something interesting I found out about Jonesboro was that its nickname is the City of Churches, because both the First Baptist Church and First Methodist Church are among the two oldest churches coming into this city, and they came between 1911 and 1916. So they're among the two oldest churches, I believe. I don't know if it was just the state or if that was like a country thing, but I thought that was interesting that two churches made them now known as the City of Churches.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
different.
So there you
very
go.
Very different. That's, so there you go. Yeah.
That's Jonesboro.
Jonesboro. My city this week, thank goodness, was a big city. So like I said, my case took place in Little Rock, Arkansas. Besides being the center of Arkansas, so I guess if you look right in the center of Arkansas, you'll know that's where Little Rock is. It's also the home of the Billy Bass Adoption Center. So do you know who Billy Bass is?
I don't.
Okay, so you know the, like, fake bass that they mount on the wall, and then he turns and he, like,
that sings?
Yeah, so that's Billy Bass. So usually it's like, don't worry, boom, 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 be happy. Yeah, so anyway, so that's the Billy Bass Adoption Center, which is a gallery displaying hundreds of singing plastic fish trophies from the 1990s. And it's found inside the Flying Fish Restaurant, which I must say, sadly, not the only retirement community for Billy Basses. I guess this is like a phenomenon around the world. But it is claimed to be the world's very first place for the retirement of Billy Basses. And if you bring a Billy Bass to donate, you receive a free basket of catfish. And then you can also get your name on a wall plaque by your donated Billy Bass. That sounds like my freaking nightmare. I hated those things more than anything. They just are so, they're so creepy, so annoying. I can't imagine walking into a room where there's just hundreds of them all of a sudden turning to you and singing.
I'm sure they have to turn that off. That would drive people crazy if they all started singing at different times and all like off, like that would just, oh my God. I would hope that they don't work. And that they're just off, and then they don't look at you, because yeah, they're like Furbies that you put on the wall. Furbies are terrible. I like that was the one '90s toy that I'm like, no, thank you.
Oh, Furbies I have a Furby.
Oh God, they're terrifying. One time I was at my friend's house, and the Furby wouldn't close its eyes, so we put it in the closet because we were having a sleepover, and then the thing started talking in the closet. I was like, no. I was like, oh my God, it's alive. Nope. I would never own a Furby.
So if you want to visit a whole bunch of Billy Basses, go to the Flying Fish Restaurant in Little Rock in Arkansas so you can see a whole bunch of them. The very first Billy Bass Adoption Center. So I have the state fact for this week. So did you know that Arkansas is the only state in North America where you can find diamonds?
I did not know that.
Well, it's apparently true. So the largest diamond ever discovered in North America was found in Crater of Diamonds State Park in 1924, which is located in Arkansas, and it was 40.23 carats large, and it was named Uncle Sam. So more than 33,000 diamonds have been found by park visitors since Crater of Diamonds became Arkansas State Park in 1972. And the cool thing about this state park is that it is the only place in the world that allows the public to keep diamonds that they find. So,
oh, wow.
A 13-year-old girl from Missouri apparently found a 2.93-carat diamond in the Crater of Diamond State Park. And so because of that, diamonds are Arkansas's state gem.
Very cool. So. I never would have guessed that that was the state fact for Arkansas. That's cool. You go, Arkansas.
I know. I think it's really cool that they let you keep them. Like,
that is pretty cool. If I ever go to Arkansas, I'm going to go to that park, find me some diamonds. Diamonds aren't really my stone, but no. I just think it'd be cool to find a gem like that. Oh,
you're and a I get to keep girl. It.
Yep. No diamonds for me. Not a fan.
No, but it would be cool if you actually found the diamond. Not that you would necessarily even have to wear it, but like.
No, just that I found it. I could say that I found a diamond.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. All right. That was a pretty cool state fact. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So thank you guys for listening. Actually, today is a special day too. I know we're recording, but we just hit 1,000 plays. So thank you guys so much for listening to us.
Yes.
It really means a lot to us that we got here, and we're only halfway through. So we're like, I think in the middle of the country at this point, maybe. No, there's how many states? 50. There's 50 states. So we're not even at 25. Don't laugh at me. It is 9 o'clock and I am done.
There are 50 states. Although they have been voting to make District of Columbia a state. So
yeah. So who we knows? Might have 51.
Maybe
yep. And if so, we'll do as soon as they become a state, we'll do an episode just on DC.
Just to celebrate it.
Just to celebrate it. But yeah, so we're not even halfway through the country yet, and we already got 1,000 plays. So that's awesome. Thank you, guys. Yay. But yeah, so thank you guys for listening to us. Make sure you like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at SOM Podcast. If you like what you hear, please, please, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or even Facebook. You can recommend the page to other people, and you can write a little review about it. It really helps us to reach more listeners and to get the word out. You don't even have to write a review. Just like give us a bunch of stars. It'll be awesome. Yep. We'll appreciate it and we'll love you forever and ever. And yes, so don't forget to check out www.stateofmurder.com after each episode, because we have bonus content, links that we mentioned, pictures, all the links to the resources that we use to find our information. So if you want to do further research or if you want to take a look at what it is that we're talking about, feel free to do that. And yeah, next week, I believe we're going to be in Missouri.
We will be. And I will share the story of the town that I got police escorted out of.
Oh, snap. That sounds like our opener.
Yeah, sounds I think it'll be a fun story.
Sounds exciting. And spoiler alert, not a state I've been to. So we're still waiting. We're still holding out for that one other state I've been to.
So just keep listening. Keep us all on pins and needles, although I know which one it is. But I'm not telling.
Yeah, we're going to have to wait till we get to it.
Yep. So thank you guys for listening, and have a good day or night or whenever you listen.
Yeah, just have a good life.
Have a great life.
Yeah, thanks. All right, thanks. Bye.
Bye.